right? So that's the equation of geodetic deviation, and it tells you very directly what the Riemann curvature is. The Riemann curvature causes two geodesics to progressively change in their separation. Of course, the separation of two geodesics to progressively change. And then I've given you some more exercises on the bottom. And this is including torsion to show that commutator of two covariant derivatives on a covariant vector is given by the torsion plus this Riemann curvature term. So if the torsion is zero, then the Riemann curvature directly measures the fact that the covariant derivatives do not commute, unlike ordinary derivatives, right? So with ordinary partial derivatives, they commute. But the covariant derivative doesn't commute, and the extent to which it doesn't commute is measured by the torsion and the Riemann curvature. Likewise, we can't help so.
Could I have a short question?
Thanks.
The fact that the covariant derivatives don't commute, is it somehow related to the fact that this is a gauge theory? I mean, like Young-Moss theory is also there.
Yes, it is. It's very much related to that. And so there is a formulation of gravity as a gauge theory of the Lorentz group, where the Lorentz group, so the Lorentz group is SO31. And if you imagine that we usually think of the Lorentz group as a global symmetry. You take X prime is a constant matrix times X. You just rotate all of space-time together. So that's a global symmetry. But if you try to make SO31 a local symmetry and gauge this SO31, then the gauge theory is related to the field strength of the gauge theory is exactly the non-commutativity of the covariant derivatives. There's some slight differences because you actually have to introduce not just the local tensor index, but a local Lorentz index as well. And so basically what you do is you write g mu nu as E you can always factorize the metric into two 4x4 matrices like this. These are called the Feuerbinds. And then it turns out that this index naturally is acted on by this SO31 matrices. And so you can perform local gauge transformations on that index. But it will turn, and then there's a gauge field associated with that gauge transformation. That's called a spin connection, W mu AB. And that's the gauge field. These are the SO31 algebra indices. So the generators of SO31 look like this. I think you've done Lie algebras, right? So the Lorentz group has these generators, sigma AB. This is the gauge field. And then it turns out directly that, there is a covariant derivative, which is the ordinary derivative plus this gauge, if this is W mu. I'm not trying to get the factors right. And then it turns out that D nu is proportional to the Riemann tensor So if I take the Riemann tensor, and so this thing is R mu nu rho lambda E A rho E B lambda. So the non-commutativity of the covariant derivative is exactly the Riemann tensor. There are some differences, because in a gauge theory, the Lagrangian is the field strength squared. In gravity, the Lagrangian is the Ricci scalar. It's not the Riemann curvature squared. It could be the Riemann curvature squared, okay, but that's not the real theory of gravity that Einstein discovered. In fact, the Riemann squared is an interesting theory called conformal gravity, but it's just not the real one. So there are some differences, which actually is still a topic of research. Okay, so the non-commutativity of covariant derivatives, if we forget about torsion, is given by the Riemann curvature. And so the commutator of two covariant derivatives on a covariant vector has a minus Riemann in it. On a contravariant vector, it's basically the same thing. With a plus sign. And then you have to just be careful to get the indices in the right place. Okay, and the general rule for the commutator of covariant derivatives on any tensor, you can probably guess. So d mu d nu on any tensor, you get a plus Riemann term for upper indices for each upper index, and a minus R for each lower index. Okay, so you can check that if you like as well. So this Riemann tensor has some very nice properties. So just to remind you, R mu nu lambda rho is minus gamma nu lambda comma rho minus gamma mu nu rho comma lambda plus R gamma gamma nu lambda gamma mu gamma rho minus gamma let me just make a comment on conventions. Okay, so one important convention is on the sign of the metric, or more specifically, the signature of g mu nu. The signature means the number of positive eigenvalues and the number of negative eigenvalues. And I'm always choosing minus plus plus plus. Okay, so this is the space, these are the space directions, and this is the time direction. In general, people who do general relativity for a living use this convention, because space is, there are more space dimensions than time dimensions. Okay, but people who do particle physics for a living generally choose the opposite convention. Because energy, if the p naught, energy is very fundamental in particle physics. And p, if you choose the opposite convention, then p with the raised index, p naught, upstairs or P naught downstairs have the same sign and both are positive. And so particle physics people generally choose the opposite dimension, plus, minus, minus, minus. Second important convention is the sign of R mu nu lambda rho. And so you'll notice I put a minus sign in front here. These indices are kind of in the obvious order compared to there. Put a minus sign in there. And the way, again, generally people who do general relativity choose this sign because, so it's chosen so that the curvature, I'll actually define in a moment what I mean by the curvature of a sphere. This is going to be the Ricci scalar, is positive. Okay, so Steven Weinberg in his book chooses this convention without the minus sign, and then the sphere actually has negative curvature, which is a bit weird. So I prefer to choose a sign in which spheres have positive curvature and hyperbolic spaces have negative curvature. Okay, so you should be aware that all the books on GR will generally pick some convention, and they all disagree, and it makes life confusing. So you have to just, in the end, pick one convention which you prefer and stick with that. I think these are the only important choices you have to make. Right. So, by the way, this expression is if the torsion equals zero. Okay, because if the torsion is zero, then, well, I derived this. This was really only the symmetric part of the Christoffel of the connection. But if the torsion is zero, then the connection is symmetric. Now, nice thing to do here is to lower the index, which will be g mu alpha r alpha nu lambda rho. And then I'll just give you the result, which you can certainly check. Mu rho nu lambda g mu lambda nu rho minus g nu rho mu lambda plus g lambda nu rho mu. And then we have plus g alpha beta gamma alpha gamma beta minus gamma beta. Okay, so that's useful. That's a useful form, too. And as we discussed before, we can choose a coordinate system at a point. We can choose a coordinate system such that at a point, at some point, gamma equals zero, because gamma involves only first order symmetric, and we can set all of these equal to zero at one space-time point. And so the kind of important term in the Riemann curvature in such a coordinate system is this one, the second derivative of the metric. But this has a lot of symmetry. Okay, so naively, the number of second derivatives of the metric would be 4 times 4 times 4 times 4, right? Would be a lot. It's 256. But actually, you don't get a general second derivative of the metric. You only get them in this combination. And this combination has a lot of symmetries that reduce the number of independent components. Okay, so the symmetries of the Riemann tensor. The first one is symmetry, but it's symmetric under exchanging the pairs of indices. R mu nu lambda rho equals R lambda rho mu nu. Okay, so I just took these two pairs and exchanged them. So that's an important symmetry, and you can check that this expression is symmetric because mu rho gets switched to mu rho over there. Partial derivatives commute, so rho mu and mu rho are the same after this comma. Okay. And likewise, this term, mu lambda, gets switched with that one. So that's that symmetry is obvious from the form. And by the way, if you derive a tensor equation in one coordinate system, we picked a coordinate system at a point, p, such that gamma was 0, and we inferred this identity, okay, in that coordinate system. But this is a tensor equation, so it's actually valid in any coordinate system. So this is frequently a useful trick. Pick a coordinate system, derive some identity between tensors in that coordinate system, and then you know it's valid in all coordinate systems. So it's a shortcut for many calculations. Yep.
Is it a problem that this only is valid at the point P?
No, because it's valid in any coordinate system at the point P. And the point P was arbitrary. So it's valid at all points in all coordinate systems. Okay. So yeah, it's funny how powerful this argument is, but it's actually extremely powerful. Yep. Okay. Secondly, we have some anti-symmetry properties. And so you'll see that if we exchange the first two indices, then I get a minus sign. Right? So if I exchange mu with nu, then the first term and the third term switch between them, and the second term with the last term. Right? Remember, g is symmetric on its two indices, and the partial derivatives commute, so the second two indices are, it's also, the second two indices commute in any one of those two those terms involving derivatives of g. Likewise, if I flip the last two indices, I get a minus sign. And if I do both, in other words, flip both the first pair and the second pair, then I get a plus sign. Okay, so there's a plus sign because I've done two flips, and each one of them has given me a minus sign. So again, you can read that off the formula, and the derivation's valid in one coordinate system, so it must be true in any coordinate system. The third property is cyclicity. And cyclicity means you keep the first index fixed and then permute the last three indices. You cycle the last three indices, I should say, plus R mu lambda rho nu. And this one you can derive from the Jacobi identity. Okay, so one of the fundamental properties of any algebra is the Jacobi identity, which is that if I have three quantities, A, B, and C, and I compute the double commutator of A, B, and C, so, well, let me write it down, d mu d nu, I just totally anti-symmetrize d lambda. Okay, so take three derivatives and anti-symmetrize. There are six terms in that expression. And this acting on any scalar is actually equal to minus a half the Riemann curvature alpha mu nu times V gamma. Sorry, I think I've got wrong indices. Alpha. So you see, the point is d alpha psi is a vector. So one of these derivatives acting on psi gives you a vector. And then I'll have the commutator of the other two vectors. Okay, so I'll have three terms like that.
What is the relation between psi and u?
Sorry, yeah, I should have d psi. V is d psi. So the point is, I've already given you an identities involved in the commutators on a vector. So now just replace that vector with a scalar, with a gradient of a scalar. And the same formula is true. And you can just check the numerical factor if you like. But the point is that this is equal to 0. And that's a consequence of this Jacobi identity, which says that d mu with d nu d alpha plus d alpha with d mu d nu plus d nu with d alpha d mu equals 0. And that's just a basic property of any algebra. Just write out all of these terms, you'll find that they all cancel in pairs. So the left-hand side is 0, so it must be that the totally anti-symmetric part of the Riemann tensor on the last three indices is 0. But if you remember our discussion of Maxwell, we had d alpha f beta gamma plus cycles was some quantity. And then we showed this is completely anti-symmetric, right? When you write this out, if f is anti-symmetric, then this quantity is anti-symmetric. D beta f gamma alpha. So that quantity is totally anti-symmetric if f is anti-symmetric. And that's essentially what we've done here. Okay, we've got some quantity Riemann, which was anti-symmetric on the last two indices. And we just cycled it. So this quantity is actually completely anti-symmetric on the last three indices. Rho nu lambda. But by this equation, it must be 0. Okay, so that's the third important symmetry of the Riemann curvature. So now it's interesting to ask, how many components are there, independent components of Riemann? So just think about it the following way. We've got this tensor with two pairs of indices. Okay, each pair of indices, the object is anti-symmetric. Okay, so in n dimensions, each index takes how many values? So it's a 2x2 matrix with in n dimensions, and it's anti-symmetric. So how many components?
N minus 1.
nn minus 1 over 2, right? Right? When I have an anti-symmetric matrix, the diagonal is 0. The off-diagonal elements are equal and opposite. So I just need to take the elements in the upper triangle. And so first one can, so there are n minus 2 values because of the anti-symmetry. And so, but this is symmetric. So I've got a matrix, symmetric matrix, where the indices of the matrix, I regard a pair of index as one index, okay? And each pair takes this many values, and then I'm symmetric under those. Now, a symmetric matrix has n plus 1 over 2 components, because you take the n minus 1 over 2, and you add the diagonal, which is where there are n elements. So the number of components is this thing, n minus 1 over 2 times n minus 1 over 2 plus 1 divided by 2. And so if you work that out, you'll get 1/8 n minus 1 n squared minus n plus 2. So those are the number of components of the Riemann tensor when I've used up these properties, A and B. But I still have this cyclicity to use up. So that's called cyclicity. And the cyclicity, well, actually, we've already discussed that it's completely anti-symmetric on those three indices. But actually, it is, so it's not hard to see that it is anti-symmetric on all three indices, on all four indices. Oh, sorry, no. Sorry, that's wrong. It's only anti-symmetric on the three indices. That's actually all I need. Okay, so we've already shown that. So anti-symmetric on all three indices on those. Let me just see. Oh, no, sorry, that is correct. Sorry, it's correct what I was saying. In fact, it's anti-symmetric on all four indices. So it's anti-symmetric on these last three, and then all I need to do is exchange this mu index with nu, for example. Okay, obviously this one is anti-symmetric just by this property. And if you go through it, you'll find that actually it is anti-symmetric on all four indices. And so then the cyclicity imposes some extra constraints. And this is n minus 1, n minus 2, n minus 3 over 4 factorial constraints. And so the number of independent components equals this number minus that number. Okay, let me call that A and call this B. So this is just A minus B. And that turns out to be n squared over 12, n squared minus 1. So the number of components of the Riemann tensor. So in n dimensions, if n equals 1, the number is 0. So if I'm on a line doesn't have any Riemann curvature. That's obvious because it's only one index, one value for the index, and it's anti-symmetric on any indices, so you can't possibly have a non-zero value. So there's no curvature in one dimension. In two dimensions, there's one component. It's just R1212. It's the only component you could have, plus arrangements obtained just by permuting. And in three dimensions, there are 6. And in four dimensions, there are 20. OK? And that's exactly the number we saw, the number of second derivatives which we saw we could not set 0 by a coordinate transformation.
A question?
Yeah.
Could you please explain the constraint part?
The cyclicity?
Yes.
OK. So the first point is that this quantity here is a completely anti-symmetric tensor. Okay, the left-hand side is completely anti-symmetric. So if that's true, you can ask how many components of a completely anti-symmetric tensor are there? Okay, so it's completely anti-symmetric. So I can pick n values for index 1. But for index 2, the only way I'll get a non-zero answer if this is different than index 1. So that's n minus 1, that's n minus 2, that's n minus 3. But then I can permute these indices in 4 factorial ways, and they're all the same value because it's, or related by a minus sign, because it's anti-symmetric. So, so that's the number of independent components. Okay, so this is just generalizing what you do for an anti-symmetric matrix. Anti-symmetric matrix, I'll say how many components are there of A, given that A satisfies this equation, the diagonal components have to be 0 by this equation. A12 is minus A21. So if I write out the matrix, this is A12, A13, A14, A23, A24, A34. The guys down here are just the minus of these, and there are 6 of these because I can pick the first in 3 ways. I can pick the first in 4 ways and the second in 3 ways, and I divide by 2.
One question, but
yeah.
Are the constraints of competing symmetricity independent from the constraints of indices being anti-symmetric?
Is this one independent of that?
Yeah, I mean, the way you
can. Yes. So you cannot prove this formula. So the important content here was really that this equals 0. You cannot prove this formula from the first two. First two do not imply that.
OK, but when you make it completely anti-symmetric, you are using the B properties, the second property. So
yes, you do use it, but it's not sufficient.
Yeah, okay, but if you
these two do not imply that. These are really independent.
No, but A, B, and C together contains a bit more information that we need. So you need to, if you use A, B, and modified C, where you take all 4 of them on the symmetric, then it contains no extra information.
I see what you mean. Yeah, that's okay. True. Yes. So because this is totally anti-symmetric, I could actually contract it with that. Well, only in 4 dimensions. This epsilon with 4 indices only exists in... yeah, that's right. Only exists in 4 dimensions. So in 4 dimensions, there's really only one component here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's completely the sentence below C does not refer to the Riemann tensor, but to the equation that we get to the constraint, right?
So this equation is the same as saying IE R mu lambda rho equals 0. Okay? So this equation are identical. Once I use the antisymmetry.
The last sentence does not say that Riemann tensor is completely antisymmetric. It says that the equation that we get is completely antisymmetric.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. So this refers to C. This is antisymmetric on all four indices, not the Riemann curvature. Okay, so those are the number of components of the Riemann curvature. And we see that somehow this Riemann curvature encodes all of the second derivatives of the metric, which cannot be set zero by a coordinate transformation. So that suggests the following, and this is a theorem, which is actually proven in Steven Weinberg's book. The theorem, the metric is flat, which means G equals eta in some coordinate system. If and only if the Riemann curvature is zero everywhere. Okay, so that's a very powerful theorem that if you calculate the Riemann curvature and you find it's not zero, the metric is definitely not flat. And conversely, if you calculate it and you find it zero in any coordinate system, then the metric is definitely flat.
Does it mean that if you do the Taylor expansion of G, as previously?
Yes.
All the other terms also vanish, so they're proportional to the Riemann tensor?
If you say that again, if I do the test.
The way you got those 20
equations, yes.
Those 20 non-vanishing components. Also
right.
In fact, the later term, I mean.
Yes.
So does this mean that the later terms also vanish because of RB?
There is some coordinate system in which the metric is eta. You see, that was the metric at a point.
Yeah.
Okay, and the first a Taylor series around a point. So I picked a coordinate system in which G was eta, the first derivative was zero, and then the second derivatives in that coordinate system will vanish if the Riemann curvature is zero. Yes.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that the third derivative has to vanish.
No.
But does that imply that it's flat?
Yes.
but it is also possible to come up with coordinate systems in which the second derivatives are non-zero.
Sorry?
It is also possible to come up with coordinate systems such that at a point the metric is eta, but
right.
The second derivatives are non-zero, even if r is zero every.
Yes, time. I think. Okay, let me think if that's
so,
right.
What it really says is that it is possible to choose such coordinates that G is eta everywhere.
Yes.
That's the content of the thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
If R is zero everywhere, then it is possible to choose coordinates in G in which G is eta everywhere. Okay? So, I'm not sure about this question. If I pick some general coordinates, so just take flat space and ask, can I pick coordinates where the second derivative of the metric is not zero in flat space? You probably can.
Yeah, you can.
You probably can, but it doesn't really mean anything. Okay. Okay. So just to spell this out, flat, a flat space or space-time is true if the Riemann curvature is zero. And a space is curved implies and is implied by the Riemann curvature being not zero. Okay, so this Riemann curvature is an incredibly powerful thing. If you know it's not zero, you know space is curved. If you know it's zero, you know space is flat. Yeah.
So
So also by the theorem, there are spaces that aren't flat in the most natural sense that have Riemann curvature equal to zero everywhere. So
no,
any space where two parallel lines stay parallel are going to be considered flat even if they have some kind of a bending.
No.
Are there no such spaces?
I'm not sure what the question is.
I'm just trying to understand. So would that mean that can you do a coordinate transformation that makes your space not just flat in the most natural sense?
No,
so
I mean,
the
picture you should have in mind is that the space really doesn't depend on the coordinates. Okay?
Right. Okay.
The space has its own existence and its own intrinsic properties. The problem is that our minds do not work without coordinates. Okay, we're just too dumb, okay, to picture a space for what it really is. So we can't look at a space and say, aha, it's curved or it isn't curved, without introducing these coordinates, which are completely artificial. Right? And so what we're always looking for is when we introduce these coordinate systems, which we know are just artificial, can we derive properties which are somehow valid in all possible coordinate systems? And those are the intrinsic properties of the space. And the Riemann tensor is an intrinsic property of the space, completely independent of the coordinate system. You see, I mean, I kind of alluded to this in a few lectures ago, where I said that a tensor, you see, when I use this coordinate notation, it seems like the tensor really only makes sense in one coordinate system. You know, the values of the components make sense in a coordinate system. But in a sort of fancier approach, you can introduce a basis for the tangent space, blah, 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 and construct the Riemann tensor as a sort of intrinsic object, which is coordinate independent. And I've just avoided that because actually it is a lot of blah, blah, blah. Okay? It won't help you one iota with real calculations. When we do real calculations, we have to use coordinates. And by the way, there's a common problem, which is that students exactly at your stage tend to get seduced by textbooks which say, we will do everything in a coordinate-free notation. Okay? Don't be seduced, okay? Because those textbooks are even more confusing, okay, in my opinion, than simply doing it in coordinates and demanding that it be valid in all coordinate systems. It's very easy to get yourself confused by endless mathematical definitions, which don't really introduce what I would say is any important new insight. An example is, you know, if you ask mathematicians who work in differential geometry, how do you really prove the most advanced theorems? I mean, one of them is Donaldson's theorem. He proved some incredible properties of four-dimensional manifolds. And he totally proved it in coordinates. Okay? And then once you've done that, you try to check, is this really valid in any coordinate system, and so on. So working mathematicians keep their actual calculations, to themselves, and then they try to make them beautiful after the fact. And don't try to short-circuit that, because it might seem to you, oh, this is horrible, I've got all these indices, and this whole subject is a nightmare. But there is no escape from that. Okay? It's just, so don't be shy about using indices. You better get used to doing big calculations with lots of indices. Okay, so are there any other questions? There's another important identity.
So are you saying that there's no point in actually using the spin connection to the field binds?
No, that's a whole different thing. That's a whole different story. No, there's a lot of physics there. The gauge theory of gravity is a whole different thing. No, what I'm really referring to is you will, for example, Bob Wald's book on general relativity, he will tell you that he's going to do everything without coordinates. And they introduce some very odd notation, which is to kind of abstract index notation, where these don't really take any values. And this is an abstract index, which is nevertheless coordinate independent. And, you know, good luck, okay? But what I can tell you is, you know, he's a good general relativist, but honestly, this is the most confusing thing I've ever read.
People sometimes call the field binds as non-coordinate places.
Yeah, that's a different thing. That's really a different thing. So essentially for the first approach to GR, and the way I'm doing it, using a coordinate basis is a very, very good idea. Okay? So you think about all these equations as being valid in one coordinate system and then valid in all coordinate systems. Non-coordinate basis means, essentially means rewriting the metric in that form, okay, and in the form of two E's. And then, deriving equations. I mean, there's these Morrow-Cartan equations and so on, which are equations for the E's. And that can be better, it can be faster for some calculations. But it's kind of a technical device. It doesn't always work. It doesn't always make things faster. So I first time around with GR, I honestly would advise you to stick with this. And this is very elementary. It's just matrices and calculus. And then you really know what you're doing. OK, so let's define some other quantities. Maybe it's good to draw some pictures at this point. What this means is if the Riemann curvature is zero, if I'm sitting in a box like Einstein imagined a thought experiment, and I let two particles go, which are parallel, they're just going to remain parallel. Okay, so that is R equals zero. But if R is not zero, and I let these two particles go, their trajectories will change. The separation of the trajectories will change, even if they were initially parallel. So other tensors. So the Riemann curvature gives the full curvature properties of the space. But you can also contract it. Now, because it's anti-symmetric on the first two or the second, on the first or second pair of indices, you can't contract those. But you can contract, say, the first with the third. Okay, so you can contract R lambda alpha lambda beta. That's not zero. There's no symmetry there which sets this equal to zero. And so this is called, and that's actually symmetric under alpha and beta, because I'm allowed to switch the first two and the second. I'm allowed to switch the first pair and the second pair of indices. That's the symmetry property. And so this is called the, that's the Ricci tensor, and it has 10 components, just because it's a symmetric 4x4 matrix in four dimensions.
Are they all independent?
Yes, they're all independent.
One question, if the Ricci tensor is zero, all the components of the Riemann are zero?
Yes. If Riemann is zero, Ricci is obviously zero, because by definition. But the other does not hold.
Okay.
Riemann has 20 components. Ricci only contains 10 of them. So you can have these 10 components being zero, but the other 10 are not zero.
But if it's called in all the space, it's, I mean, if the Ricci tensor is zero in all the space, it can still not be a flat.
It's not flat, yeah. Ricci being zero does not guarantee flatness. In fact, the metric for a black hole is definitely not flat. But the Ricci tensor is zero. Ricci tensor is zero for a black hole, for example. In fact, zero for any solution of the Einstein equations without matter present. OK, so then the Ricci scalar also called a curvature scalar, is obtained just by contracting the Ricci tensor. So R is G alpha beta R alpha beta. And that has only one component. So again, you can have many spaces where the curvature, Ricci curvature scalar is not zero, but Riemann is, Ricci curvature is zero, but Riemann curvature is not zero.
Question?
Yeah?
What does Ricci tensor measure geometrically?
I can't tell you.
What does it tell us?
Can't tell you. I don't know. Something. The Weyl tensor. So this is a very important tensor. Whoops. What am I doing in front? I didn't. So the Weyl tensor is defined this way. Looks a bit of a mess, but there is some logic to it. So you take the Riemann curvature, and then basically you keep subtracting all things off. Okay, so the Weyl curvature is just the Ricci curvature with a bunch of things subtracted, all of them linear. Sorry, it's the Riemann tensor with a bunch of things subtracted, all of them linear in the Riemann tensor. And they are subtracted in such a way that G alpha mu C alpha beta mu nu equals zero. Okay? Remember, the Riemann tensor is traceless on the first two indices, right? Because it's anti-symmetric. So if I take my R alpha beta mu nu and I take the trace on the first two indices, that just means contracting with the G, okay? Because if I contract with the G, I raise one of the two indices and then I sum over beta. So that's called taking the trace. But this is identically zero. So you can't take the trace. You can't get anything non-zero by tracing the Ricci tensor on the first two indices or the last two indices. So, but what you can do is trace it on the first and the third, say. The Weyl tensor is constructed so that I subtract off a bunch of stuff to ensure that this equation is true. So the Weyl tensor is traceless on any i.e., traceless, i.e., C alpha beta mu nu is traceless on any pair of indices. And that's the defining property of the Weyl tensor. And it turns out it has 10 independent components in four dimensions. And so when you think about where does the curvature live, the Riemann tensor has 20 components. You can think of 10 of them being the Ricci tensor and the other 10 being the Weyl tensor. So you can think about this as i.e. Riemann equals Ricci plus Weyl. So even so, I mentioned the black hole has zero Ricci tensor, but the Weyl tensor is not zero. And the Weyl tensor is essentially this tracelessness on two indices tells you something about the geometry of solutions of Einstein equations, something very important. And then there's another theorem, which I think is also proven in Weinberg's book, Steven Weinberg's book, that C alpha beta mu nu, if the Weyl tensor is zero, then the metric is omega squared x beta mu nu. Then the metric is conformally flat. Okay, this omega squared is called a conformal factor. Eta is eta. Then there exists a coordinate system. Okay, so that's kind of interesting. And in cosmology, the Weyl tensor will turn out to be zero. So for cosmological solutions of the Einstein equations, where space and time are expanding, then it turns out the metric is conformally flat. And those of you who may have watched Roger Penrose's recent lecture on Purser, on cyclic cosmology, you know that this was a sort of fundamental observation that he was using. Some more identities, the Bianchi identities. And so these are differential identities on the Riemann tensor. And they look like this. Okay, in the following notation, so some tensor alpha, beta, mu. So what does that mean? That means covariant derivative T alpha, beta. Okay, so I've used this notation. T alpha, beta, comma, mu is ordinary derivative, right? Partial derivative, d by dx, mu. So this comma means partial derivative. Semicolon means covariant derivative. Yeah, that's wrong. Sorry. Thanks. So you'll notice what we do in this equation is something familiar even from electromagnetism, which is we just keep the first two indices fixed. And the second two indices were antisymmetric on Riemann, right? So I differentiate, and then I cycle them. So the kappa comes in front of the mu nu, then I cycle the nu in front of the kappa mu. So you can already tell this is totally antisymmetric. Antisymmetric. On the last three indices, mu, nu, kappa. So how do you prove that? Well, it's totally anti-symmetric on three indices, so the natural guess is the Jacobi identity. So derive, so I'll just leave this as an exercise, derive from Jacobi, i.e. d mu d nu d rho plus d rho d mu d nu plus d nu d rho d mu. Okay, all of that acting on some vector has to be zero. Okay, so the Jacobi identity is zero. I mean, this set of all these four, these derivatives is just identically zero. Just add up all the terms. But you can work them all out because we already figured out how to calculate the commutator of derivatives on a vector, and it gives you the Riemann tensor. And then you'll come along and differentiate the Riemann tensor. And eventually, you will get that equation. So that's quite a long exercise. And you may prefer just to believe me that this is true. But in any case, do try the following exercise, which is to contract indices in this equation. So it has five free indices to obtain the following identity, which is very important, r rho nu minus 1/2 g rho nu r equals 0. So the Ricci tensor is not the divergence of the Ricci tensor. This is like the divergence because you're contracting two indices. Divergence isn't zero, but if you subtract off the Ricci scalar with this coefficient, then it is zero. And that quantity is defined to be g rho nu, which is the Einstein tensor. And this is something figured out by Einstein. In fact, in the first version of his equation he published, Einstein set the Ricci, first equation Einstein wrote down was r mu nu equals constant times t mu nu. That's the matter stress-energy tensor. And the matter stress-energy tensor obeys the conservation law like this. Okay, but the problem is that the Ricci tensor does not. And so the first version of Einstein's equations he wrote down was just mathematically inconsistent. And this was eventually pointed out, and he corrected it after a few months. But there's a very famous photograph of Einstein on a blackboard explaining his theory of gravity. And he actually has this equation down, which is wrong. Okay. If you look on it, you'll see it says r mu nu on the left-hand side. So even Einstein got some things wrong. Okay, so that is basically that for the mathematics we need. And then I think next lecture we're going to, we'll go back to the geodesic equation for a particle moving in a curved metric. And we'll see how that geodesic equation reproduces Newton's law of motion for a particle under gravity. In other words, we'll see how a particle moving in a curved space looks like a particle moving in a gravitational field. That'll be the first step. And that will basically allow us to interpret so in Newton's theory of gravity, we have d2x dt squared. The acceleration of a particle is minus the grad phi, because that's the force, the gravitational force per unit mass. Okay, so Einstein's key observation was that the mass cancels in this equation. F equals ma, but the force on a particle in a gravitational field is the mass times the gradient of the gravitational potential. And so this basically looks like a geodesic equation, okay? Because here you have the d2x dt squared. This is the connection. So Einstein's first observation is, aha, we can explain gravity as just a consequence of the curvature of space-time as encoded in the connection. The second point is that in Newton's theory of gravity, you have Poisson's equation. Okay, that this gravitational potential is determined by the matter, by the mass, right? So this is gm over r squared. But phi is gm over r, and gm over r is a solution of Poisson's equation, where rho is a spherical distribution of mass. Okay? So the question is, what is this equation in tensors? And naturally here, you see the connection involves first derivatives of the metric, right? So this tells you that the metric must involve phi. And this gives me the connection, which is first derivatives of phi. What is second derivative of phi? Second derivative of phi must be second derivatives of the metric. Okay, so that has to be something involving the Riemann tensor. And this is the matter density. So basically, you must have Newton's constant, and you must have the stress tensor. And that's why he guessed this equation, right, with G here. And it was almost right, except he had to correct it by subtracting this half GR from it. Okay, so we'll go through this in detail next time.